Will felt himself startle. I knew he was gay. I wasn't that naive. She shrugged. It was the '70s. Everybody thought gay people could change.
Will tried to get over his shock.
Was it too late with Roger? About a half a century too late. He wanted a stay-at-home wife and I wanted a career.
She looked at her watch, then at the closed door.
At least he showed me what an orgasm was.
Will put his head in his hands and prayed for self-immolation.
Oh, stop it.
Amanda stood up, indicating sharing time was over.
Wilbur, I have known you for more years than I care to admit, and you have always been a raving idiot in your personal life. Don't screw things up with Sarah. She is too good for you, and you'd better find a way to keep her before she figures that out.
She grabbed his hand and slid the ring off his finger. He watched her stomp over to the desk and toss the ring into the trash can. The metal made a dinging sound, like the hammer hitting the bell at the end of round one.
And don't tell any of this to Faith. She has no idea her uncle is gay.
The door opened. The receptionist said, Mr. Kilpatrick will see you now.
Thank you.
Amanda waited for Will to stand up and follow her. Will put his hands on his knees and pushed himself up from the couch. His head was spinning through the slideshow of everything Amanda had just told him, but he forced himself to stop the carousel and put it on a shelf. None of what she'd said mattered. Angie wasn't dead. She was off somewhere, the same place she always went to, and eventually one day his front door would open and he would hear those familiar words.
It's me, baby. Did you miss me?
A loud rebel yell shocked Will's attention back to the present. Two young guys in sharp suits high-fived each other as they celebrated something agent-y. The quiet of the lobby was gone. Phones were ringing, secretaries were murmuring into their headsets. The floating glass stairs were filled with people who looked like they had stepped out of a magazine spread. Overhead, a giant LED sign counted up the number of millions the company had made for their players so far this year. Except for the staggeringly high number, not much had changed in the 4 months since Will had been here. The life-size stickers were still on the walls. Every office door still had a beautiful young woman stationed at a desk outside. There were still photos of agents looking like Tattoo next to Mr. O'Rourke as they stood by their star players signing multi-million dollar contracts. The surly receptionist handed them over to another blonde, this one a few years older, probably with an MBA from Harvard, because hot blondes who worked in offices like this weren't just for show anymore. The new blonde told Amanda, I put your mint tea in the conference room, but Kip wanted to talk to you first. Will realized he should have asked Amanda what she hoped to accomplish here. It was normal procedure to talk to a building's owner when a dead body was found on their premises, but this wasn't Kip Kilpatrick's first rodeo. There was no way he'd let them interview Marcus Rippey, even off the record. It was too late to ask Amanda now. The blonde knocked on the office door, then let them in. Kip Kilpatrick was sitting at a massive glass table in the center of his light-filled corner office. The ceiling soared 20 feet overhead. The dull marble slabs on the floor were broken up with heavy wool rugs shot through with strings of silk. The deep couches and chairs in the seating area had been designed for giants. Kilpatrick was not a giant. His small feet rested on the edge of the table, scuffing the backs of his bespoke leather loafers. He was leaning back in the chair, tossing a basketball into the air with both hands, talking into the Bluetooth earpiece stuck in his ear because he wouldn't look douchey enough speaking into a regular phone. Kilpatrick had other clients, a top-seeded tennis player, a soccer player who had helped the U.S. take home the World Cup, but it was clear from his office who the real superstar was. It wasn't just the regulation NBA Marcus Rippey backboard mounted high on the wall. They might as well have been standing in a Marcus Rippey museum. Kilpatrick had framed jerseys going back to Rippey's youth league days. Signed basketballs lined the window ledge. Two Rippey bobbleheads sat on opposite corners of his desk. Championship trophies were on a specially designed floating shelf that had a pin light wrapping every inch of gold. There was even a pair of bronzed, size 14 basketball shoes that Rippy had worn when he helped his college team win the Final Four. Will had always assumed that Kilpatrick was a failed player. He was not too short, but not tall enough, the kind of guy who puppy-dogged the team, trying to be friends with the players while they walked all over him. The only difference now was that he at least got paid for it.
"Heads up," Kilpatrick said. He passed the basketball to Will.
Will let the ball hit him in the chest and bounce across the room. The sound echoed in the cold office. They all watched the ball dribble into the corner.
Kilpatrick said, "Guess you're not a player."
Will said nothing.
"Have I met you before?"
Will had spent 7 months hounding Kilpatrick and his people over the Rippy investigation. There was probably a dartboard in the break room with his face on it. Still, if Kilpatrick was going to pretend they had never met, that was fine with Will.
He said, "Drawing a blank."
"Me too." Kilpatrick bumped the glass table as he stood. The bobbleheads nodded.
"Miss Wagner can't say that I'm happy to see you again."
Amanda didn't tell him that the feeling was mutual.
"Thank you for moving up our meeting. I'm sure we'd all like to get this straightened out as soon as possible."
"Absolutely." Kilpatrick opened a small refrigerator packed with bottles of Bank Shot, an energy drink that tasted like cough syrup. He twisted off the cap. He took a mouthful and swigged it around before swallowing.
"Tell me, what's this again?"
"This is a murder investigation that is currently taking place at Marcus Rippey's nightclub."
When he didn't respond, Amanda said,
"As I told you on the phone, I need information about the development."
Kilpatrick chugged the drink. Will glanced at Amanda. She was being unusually patient.
"Ah."
Kilpatrick tossed the empty bottle into the trash can.
"What I can tell you right now is that I've never heard of this Harding guy."
"So the name Triangle O Holdings Limited means nothing to you?"
"Nope."
Kilpatrick grabbed the basketball off the floor.
"Never heard of it."
Will had no idea where Amanda was going with her question, but for her benefit, he explained to Kilpatrick,
"The triangle offense was made famous by Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls under Coach Phil Jackson."
"Jordan, huh?"
Kilpatrick smiled as he palmed the basketball.
"I think I heard of that guy. Like a really old Marcus Rippey."
Amanda said,
"Dale Harding was living in a very nice home, owned by Triangle O Holdings."
Kilpatrick threw the basketball toward the hoop. It hit the backboard, and he took the rebound for another shot.
"Nothing but net,"
he said, like he couldn't simply walk up and touch the bottom of the net with the tips of his fingers.
Amanda said, "Triangle O Holdings is registered in Delaware to a company that is registered in St. Martin, then St. Lucia, all the way through to a corporation held in Copenhagen."
Will felt a tickle in his brain. The construction signs outside Rippy's nightclub had a Danish flag in the logo. Amanda had obviously noticed the same detail, but earlier and when it could better serve her purpose.
"I've got the State Department making an official inquiry into the names of the corporation's board and shareholders. You could make this a lot easier if you would just tell me."
"No idea."
Kilpatrick tried to spin the basketball on the tip of his finger.
"Wish I could help you." "You could let us talk to Marcus Rippey."
He coughed a laugh.
"Not a chance, lady."
Will sneaked a glance at Amanda again, wondering what she was up to. She had to know they had lost their one shot at Marcus Rippey.
She asked, "What about the name Angie Pulaski?"
Kilpatrick finally got the ball to spin.
"What about it?"
"Have you ever heard of her?"
"Sure."
He slapped the basketball to make it spin faster.
"In what capacity?"
Let's just say she provided a service.
Background checks. Security.
Snatch. Kilpatrick got a look on his face that made Will want to punch him straight out the window.
"She provided girls for some of my parties. Nothing was expected of them. I just asked that they be experienced."
He paused and added,
"Conversationalists." "Experienced conversationalists. Like I said, nothing sexual was expected of them. They were all adults.
They were paid for their conversation. Anything else was their choice.
Choice, Will repeated, because he knew for a fact that Marcus Rippey preferred women who didn't have a choice.
Amanda summed it up.
So you're saying that Angie Pulaski provided escorts for your parties?
Kilpatrick nodded, his eyes on the spinning ball.
Will had to admit there might be something to what he was saying. Angie had loved working vice. She was always more comfortable walking the line between cop and criminal. She also knew her share of prostitutes, and she never had any problems with women making money any way they knew how.
Kilpatrick said, "My clients are high-profile celebrities. Sometimes they want a little discreet company. It's hard for them to meet women."
Amanda asked, "You mean other than their wives?"
Will thought about the working girls that Angie knew. They were low-level streetwalkers, drug addicts, some of them toothless, all of them desperate. None of them more than a few years away from a prison cell or a grave. Will might be able to imagine a world in which Angie pimped out some girls and told herself that she was doing them a favor, but the girls she knew were not the kind of ladies that Kilpatrick's clients would want to meet.
Kilpatrick said, "So that's what you wanted to know? What Pulaski was doing for me?"
"Do you have her current address?"
"Post office box." He picked up the phone, punched in some numbers, and said, "My office." He hung up the phone. "My guy Laszlo can give you the details."
Laszlo again. Will was right to assume the bullet-headed Boston thug was an extra pair of dirty hands.
Amanda asked, "How did you meet Ms. Pulaski?"
Kilpatrick shrugged his shoulders.
"The way you meet these kinds of people is they're just there. They know what you're looking for, and they offer to take care of it for a price.
Easy."
Will said, "Like bribing witnesses in a rape trial?"
Kilpatrick looked at him. Something like a snort came out of his nose.
"Yeah, now I remember who you are."
Amanda asked,
"What about a phone number?"
"Laszlo will have it. I don't deal with tradespeople."
"Right," Will said. "You just mail them the checks from your personal bank account."
Amanda shot Will a daggered look. She told Kilpatrick,
"We found a check written to Angie Pulaski drawn from your bank account."
"The agency only pays for drinks and dinners. Anything else is on us," Kilpatrick explained. "Business development is what we call it on our taxes."
Amanda said, "Let's talk about another development, the one where we found a dead body this morning."
He started to spin the ball again.
"I'll let you get that from the horse's mouth."
Amanda said, "Does that mean that everything you've told us thus far has been from the horse's other end?"
Kilpatrick took a beat to get her meaning.
There was a knock at the door. Laszlo said,
"Boss, they're ready."
Kilpatrick dribbled the basketball as he walked across the office.
"Get these people Pulaski's deets. They're cops. They're looking for her."
"Big surprise."
Laszlo grabbed the ball and shot it toward the hoop on the wall. Kilpatrick started to go for the rebound. Amanda snaked the ball and put it down on the closest chair.
"We're ready when you are, Mr. Kilpatrick."
He eyed the basketball, but thought better of it.
"This way."
He started down the hallway.
"The development is scheduled to break ground next week. We're calling it the All-Star Complex."
She asked,
"We?"
"Yeah, that's thanks to you guys."
Kilpatrick led them past a bunch of closed office doors.
"Funny thing about that jacked-up rape charge you laid on Marcus. The other investors were looking for someone else to step in, and we realized we were missing a larger opportunity."
"Meaning?"
"We pitched the investment to some of our higher-end clients. We realized we could expand the complex into a live-work community."
Amanda said,
"So, like Atlantic Station, but in an area that is historically more crime-ridden."
Will smiled. She had a point. Atlantic Station had been pitched to the city as a dream development that would turn an area of blight into a thriving tax base. As with most dreams, reality had come crashing down in the form of a spike in sexual assaults, muggings, carjackings, and vandalism. At one point, a couple of more enterprising bank robbers had strapped a chain around an ATM machine and pulled it out of the wall with their truck. Kilpatrick had obviously handled the Atlantic Station question before.
Those were growing pains. It happens. The whole thing's been turned around, as I'm sure you know. And also, the developers didn't have the benefit of 8 of the most talented, tremendous athletes the world has ever known, ready to promote the project to make sure it succeeds.
He threw his hands out like a carnival barker.
Think about it. Marcus Rippey alone has over 10 million Facebook fans. His tweets and Instagram reach twice as many as that. He puts up one post about a dope club or a hip shop he's excited about, and within the hour, the place is flooded. He's a tastemaker.
Kilpatrick turned the corner, and they were facing a vast, glass-walled conference room with a table that could accommodate 50 people. Will forced himself not to flinch in disgust when he noticed the 4 lawyers already in the room. Kilpatrick must have called in the big guns the minute Amanda had requested a meeting. Will recognized them all from the Rippey rape investigation. The interchangeable Bond villains, 2 old white men, each with a gorgeous, 30-ish woman dressed to kill sitting beside him. Kilpatrick ran through the introductions, but Will had already designated their Bond status from before. Arik Goldfinger was at the head of the table, his patches of chia-like gold hair and thick German accent earning him the name. Obviously, his blonde underling was pussy galore. Then there was Dr. Julius No, a man who for some reason always kept his hands under the table. His sidekick was Rosa Klebb, named not for her looks, which were fantastic, but because her pointy high-heeled shoes seemed like the type that would have poison-tipped knives inside of them.
Goldfinger said, "Deputy Director Agent Trent, thank you both for coming. Please sit."
He indicated a chair with a cup of tea in front of it, 2 seats away from Rosa Klebb. Will pulled out 2 chairs from the opposite end of the table, about half a mile away from the Bond quartet, because he knew that's how Amanda would want to play it. She glanced up at Will as they sat down, her eyes going to his bare neck, and he got the feeling that she was really annoyed that he wasn't wearing a suit and tie. Will was annoyed, too. He could have at least worn his gun on his hip. He needed some armor against these people. They didn't roll out of bed for less than $3,000 an hour, each. The combined receipt for this meeting was probably more than Will's take-home pay. He looked at Kilpatrick, but Kilpatrick was obviously no longer in charge. He had slumped into a chair, rolling an unopened bottle of red bank shot between his hands.
"So," Amanda chose to forego subtlety, "I'm trying to understand why it takes 4 lawyers to answer one simple question."
Goldfinger smiled. "It's not a simple question, Deputy Director. You asked for details on the property in which the victim was found. We are simply here to give you the larger picture of the situation."
Amanda said, "In my experience, there's always a larger picture where murder is concerned, but, again, it's never taken so many lawyers to draw it for me."
Will watched them carefully. No one spoke. No one moved. Despite her question, Amanda didn't seem displeased to find herself talking to the lawyers. If someone had asked Will for his opinion, he would have guessed that she'd somehow contrived to put them all in this room. The only question was, why?
Amanda set aside the tea bag and drank some tea. Finally, Goldfinger looked at Dr. No, who in turn nodded to Rosa Klebb.
Klebb stood up. She stacked together some folders. She walked around the conference table, which was about the width of a sequoia.
Will could hear her pantyhose scratching against her tight skirt.
He looked down at her extremely high-heeled shoes. The soles were red because they could stop a man's heart. Sarah had a pair from the same designer. He preferred them on Sarah.
"This is a packet on the development," Goldfinger told them. "It's the same presentation we shared with the mayor and the governor last month."
Amanda would have already heard about the project. She had talked to the mayor this morning and was briefing the governor at the Capitol when Will had given her the slip. She didn't volunteer this information. Instead, she glanced at the folder,
which had a massive star logo in the center. She handed her packet to Will. He put it on top of his packet and placed both at his elbow. Dr. No leaned over, his hands still tucked under the table.
"We'll have to ask you to keep this information to yourselves. There's a press embargo until the official announcement. You can read the details about the development in the packet."
Amanda waited. Goldfinger explained,
"The All-Star Complex will have a 16-screen movie theater, a 30-story hotel, a 20-story condominium complex, a farmer's market, an outdoor shopping mall with high-end boutique and chain stores, exclusive townhomes, a members-only nightclub, and of course a full-size basketball court adjacent to what we're calling the All-Star Experience, an interactive museum showcasing all that is wonderful about NCAA basketball."
Amanda asked,
"How will this be financed?" "We have several private investors whose names I am currently not at liberty to release."
"And foreign investors?"
Amanda prodded. Goldfinger smiled.
"A project of this scope requires many, many investors, some of whom wish to remain behind the scenes."
"Including yourselves?"
He smiled back a non-answer.
She said, "The construction company is LK Totalbygg AS, based in Denmark."
"That is correct. As you know, Atlanta is an international city. We reached out to international investors. It's a win-win for everyone involved."
Will thought about the people who actually lived in Atlanta who would be investing, whether they wanted to or not. The perks that the government handed out for these kinds of project were phenomenal. City-funded bond initiatives, decades-long state and local tax deferments, new roadways, new infrastructure, new traffic lights and cops to keep the area safe, basically all the cold hard cash that always made these developments possible for the rich guys who touted the glories of private enterprise and talked about pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. The American dream.
"Deputy Director,"
Dr. No leaned toward Amanda as if they weren't separated by an ocean of hardwood.
"As both the mayor and governor have repeatedly expressed, both the city and state are very excited about the development. The proximity to the Georgia Dome, Georgia Tech, Centennial Village, and SunTrust Park means the complex will be a mecca for tourists."
Will thought that Chattahoochee Avenue was a bit far out to be a mecca for anything, but he had to assume these guys had seen a map. Goldfinger said,
"We are hoping that the All-Star Experience will rival downtown's College Football Hall of Fame. I don't have to tell you what it would do for the city's economic opportunities if we could secure more vital slots in the March Madness rotation."
"Sounds impressive."
Amanda didn't have to know about sports to understand that this was big business. She looked down the table, expectant.
"And?"
Dr. No took over.
"And we would hope that you would understand that this is a delicate undertaking."
Pussy Galore chimed in. "It's not just the nuts and bolts of building such an impressive complex. We've put a lot of time and effort into making the announcement about the project's existence. You only get one opportunity to make that first big splash. We've got all of our all-star investors lined up to attend. We're flying in reporters from New York, Chicago, and L.A. We've booked suites and restaurants. We have a massive two-day party planned, culminating in a groundbreaking at the site. We've worked the press into a frenzy. It's very important that none of this is tainted by lingering doubt about any of the investors."
Goldfinger added, "Or about the site."
Amanda said,
"If that means you're worried we're going to charge your client with rape again, I can put your minds at ease."
She smiled.
"This is a murder case, so if we make any charges, it will be for murder."
The room lost all of its air. Goldfinger smiled, and then the smile turned into a laugh. Dr. No joined in, his hands still below the table so that he looked like a lemming caught in a blender.
Amanda asked.
When is this party planned?
This weekend.
Ah, she said, as if she finally understood, but Will would have bet his life that she knew about the launch before she walked through the door.
The mayor and the governor would have both been pressuring her harder than the lawyers to wrap up the investigation so the project could get underway. The city needed the jobs. The state needed the money. Amanda told them,
"The fact remains that a dead man was found inside the nightclub. We've got a large crime scene to process. Even with overtime, it will take at least until Saturday to catalog and photograph all of the evidence."
Not for the first time, Will admired Amanda's lying skills, because there was no way that crime scene would take that long to clear. She was playing the long game here. He just couldn't see the end point.
Goldfinger said, "This is the problem at which we have arrived. Saturday is a bit of a difficulty for us."
"Not just a bit," Galore supplied. "We promised an early peek of the club to the L.A. Times. They're scheduled for first thing Friday morning. They want to do a before and after kind of thing with Marcus, take some photos of him behind the bar, maybe standing on the balcony. Then the later photos will show the same shots after the club is finished."
"Can't you postpone that?" Amanda asked.
Galore wrinkled her nose. "The word postpone is catnip to reporters. We'd be looking at a lot of bad press." Amanda told them,
"I was inside that club this morning. It looked more like a crack den than the anchor to a $2.8 billion project."
None of them seemed to notice that she had the price tag at her fingertips. Galore supplied, "We had cleaners scheduled to go in this morning to start making the club more presentable. Obviously, that was well after your crime scene people arrived." She added,
"But still, we'd need at least 2 days, balls to the walls, to get that place spiffed up."
"You realize the press has already gotten wind of the murder?" Amanda said. "They know that a body was found inside the club."
"Yes, they know that a body was found," Galore said. "They don't know that the man was anything other than a vagrant."
"Both the GBI and the Atlanta police were on the scene. The media is going to assume that we wouldn't put that much effort into solving the murder of a vagrant."
She smiled at them.
"Not that any death isn't a tragedy, but the local police normally don't ask the state for help in such circumstances."
"So it's a drug deal gone bad, or two homeless men fighting over a 40, Galore suggested.
"That would only serve to highlight another positive aspect of the All-Star development, taking an area that is prone to crime and turning it into a safe, clean, family-friendly neighborhood."
"But he wasn't a vagrant. He was a retired Atlanta police detective."
No one had an answer for that.
Amanda said, "I'm sorry, folks. I understand the dilemma, but I can't rush a murder investigation for your grand opening. I have to think of the victim's family. The detective had a wife. She's only 22 years old."
Will worked to keep the surprise off his face. Because of the age, he had to assume that the wife was Delilah Palmer. He had no idea why Amanda hadn't shared this detail with him. There was a big difference between Harding being Delilah's guardian angel and being her husband. Wives knew things. They had access to information. If Harding was targeted for knowing too much, then Delilah would be the next person on the list.
Amanda continued, "Harding and the girl were married for only a few months. I already had to tell her that she's a widow. Am I supposed to go back now and tell her that her husband's death takes a backseat to a press event?"
Amanda shook her head, as if the very thought made her sad.
"And speaking of the press, Mrs. Harding is incredibly photogenic. Blonde hair, blue eyes, very pretty. The press will be all over her."
"No, no," Dr. No said. "We wouldn't want any of that, Deputy Director. We're not trying to impede your investigation."
He shot Goldfinger a look, because of course they were trying to impede the investigation. And Amanda would have known this already, so again, Will had to wonder what she was angling for.
"Deputy Director," Goldfinger began, "we would just ask that
You do all you can to speed things along. He held up his finger. Not speed, of course, because that would imply rushing. I would just say that you could please handle this expeditiously.
She nodded.
Of course, I'll do what I can, but I can't have my people cleared out by Saturday. There are simply not enough hours in the day.
Dr. No asked, Is there anything we can do to help expedite the process? Will felt an invisible zap come off of Amanda. Dr. No's question was exactly what she had been waiting for.
I wonder if... She stopped herself. No, never mind. We'll do all we can. She started to stand. Thank you for your time.
Please, Goldfinger motioned for her to sit.
What can we do?
She sat back down. She gave a heavy sigh.
I'm afraid it all comes back to Marcus Rippey.
Fuck no, Kilpatrick had jumped to attention.
You're not talking to Marcus. No fucking way. No fucking how.
Amanda spoke to Goldfinger.
Look at this from my perspective. I have a highly decorated, much respected ex-police detective found murdered inside a building that is under construction. In the course of a normal investigation, the first thing I would do is talk to the building owner to eliminate him or her as a suspect and to generate a list of people who would have access to the building.
I can give you a fucking list, Kirkpatrick sputtered. You don't need to talk to Marcus.
I'm afraid I do.
She held out her hands in a helpless shrug.
I just need a few moments of his time and a promise that he'll have an open and honest conversation with us. It would go a long way toward repairing his reputation if he was shown to be helping a police investigation. On the record.
Are you fucking kidding me? On the record? Kilpatrick had jumped to his feet. He told Goldfinger, You can get 5 to 10 years in this state for lying to a cop.
Amanda asked, What is your client planning to lie about?
Kilpatrick ignored her, telling Goldfinger,
This fucking spider is trying to trap Marcus into saying something that...
Kip, Dr. No said, and Kilpatrick's mouth shut like a trout. Goldfinger told Amanda,
Deputy Director, perhaps you and I could speak in private.
The other three lawyers stood in unison. Amanda touched Will's arm, releasing him. He headed toward the door. Kilpatrick threw his hands into the air.
This is bullshit, man! Bullshit!
The trio of lawyers had already dispersed. Will watched Kilpatrick from the hallway. He said bullshit 2 more times before leaving the room. He tried to slam the glass door behind him, but it was on a pneumatic closer. Like magic, Laszlo appeared at Will's elbow. Kilpatrick jabbed his finger at both of them, red-faced, furious.
Walk this peckerhead to the lobby, then come back to my office, pronto!
Kilpatrick punched the wall. The sheetrock flexed, but didn't puncture. He kicked it to the same effect before stalking away.
Hey, peckerhead!
Laszlo indicated the long walk back to the lobby.
This way.
Laszlo. Will looked over the guy's head, taking advantage of the half-foot difference. He wasn't going to leave without Amanda, and something about the thug had rubbed him the wrong way.
You got a last name?
Yeah, it's Go Fuck Yourself. Now start moving.
Laszlo, go fuck yourself.
Will didn't move.
You got a card?
I got my size 10 up your ass if you don't get moving, buddy.
Will forced a chuckle. He put his hands in his pockets like he had all day.
What the fuck are you laughing at?
Will couldn't tame the thing inside of him that wanted to piss this guy off. He thought about the old lady from the lobby, the way her bottom lip had trembled. Was that because of Laszlo? Kip Kilpatrick? Will felt instinctively that something was there. He told Laszlo,
Mrs. Lindsay warned me you're a pistol.
Laszlo's expression darkened,
which meant Will had hit a nerve. Will wondered what the guy's rap sheet looked like back in Boston. He imagined there was some weight to it. He had prison ink on the side of his neck and the look of a man who could take a beating and still win the fight. Laszlo warned,
You stay away from the old lady or I will fuck you up.
You'd better bring a ladder.
Don't think as you're a cop I won't take you down.
Laszlo put his hands on his hips, which Will thought was only appropriate for a man if he was standing on the sidelines at a game.
Laszlo's tight shirt gaped open.
The material was stretched so thin that he could have saved his dry-cleaning bill and painted it on. He glared at Will, asking,
"What are you looking at, faggot?"
"That's a nice shirt. Does it come in adult sizes?" The conference room door opened.
"Thank you so much,"
Amanda called to Goldfinger. She smiled at Will, triumph putting a twinkle in her eyes. Marcus Rippey was important, but not as important as a $2.8 billion deal that everyone wanted a piece of. Amanda asked Will,
"Ready?"
Laszlo jabbed his thumb down the hall.
"This way." "Thank you, Mr. Zivkovic."
Amanda took the lead toward the lobby. She asked Laszlo,
"Did you manage to find the phone number from Ms. Pulaski?"
He didn't look away from Will as he passed her a piece of folded notepaper. Amanda glanced at the number, then handed it to Will. It was for the same disconnected line that was on everything. Laszlo yanked open the lobby door.
"Anything else I can do for y'alls?"
He put on a hick accent that, layered on top of his Boston accent, made him sound like he was recovering from a stroke. Amanda said,
"Young man, surely you've lived down here long enough to know that y'all is a second-person plural pronoun."
The comment was meant to be the last, but Will had a question for Laszlo.
"Did you know Angie?" "Pulaski?"
A toothy grin spread across his round face.
"Sure, I knew her."
He gave Will a knowing wink.
"She had a cunt like a boa constrictor."
"Had?" Amanda asked. He slammed the door in their faces.
Chapter 6 Faith sat in an uncomfortable plastic chair across from the nurse's station inside the Grady Hospital ICU. There were armed guards at either end of the hall. The ward was full. Grady was Atlanta's only public hospital, a level one trauma center that saw most of the bad cases the city had to offer. At any given time, at least a quarter of the patients were handcuffed to their beds. She glanced up at the whiteboard behind the desk. Olivia, the head nurse, was updating the status of one of the patients. Grady admitted a lot of Jane Doe's, but Faith only cared about her potential witness, Jane Doe, too. She was still marked critical. The junkie's surgery had taken 4 hours longer than planned. They'd had to rebuild her nose and throat. So much blood had been replaced that they'd basically put her into rapid detox from the coke. And now she was pumped full of morphine. She would be out of it for at least another hour minimum. At least Faith hadn't let her time go to waste. She had tackled Dale Harding's financial documents and phone records, not that the task got her anywhere closer to a solution, let alone a clue to follow. Harding's phone calls were all for pizza or Chinese delivery, so he must have used a burner phone for business. As for his bank records, it didn't take a forensic accountant to understand the figures. Harding kept less than $100 in his checking account, a number that hadn't fluctuated much over the last 6 months because he had used a gold MasterCard to charge everything, from his gorditas at Taco Bell to the support hose that kept the circulation going in his legs. The cumulative balance on the card for the last 6 months was $46,000 and change. Harding had stopped making payments on the bill. Faith assumed this was by design. He'd stopped dialysis, basically signing his own death warrant. He'd obviously planned to screw as many people as he could on his way out. The question was, had one of those people been Delilah Palmer? Faith couldn't stop thinking about porn photos. The dead look in the girl's eyes. Even back to 10 years old, Delilah seemed to show the resignation that it was her fate to be used by every man who crossed her path. Not just any man, but Dale Harding. A cop. A father. The one person she should have been able to trust, and he kept nasty photos of her in his attic, and married her because... why?
Delilah had to be the key to both murders.
Faith didn't buy Collier's feminist theory that the girl was behind their deaths. Harding had always taken care of Delilah. She would have known that he didn't have much time left. Why kill the guy when she could just wait a few days and dance on his grave? Faith could think of a lot of people who would want Angie Pulaski dead, so she kept the focus on Dale Harding. He was a gambler. He took risks.
He had likely taken a final risk before his death, something with a big payout.
Which meant that Delilah, his legal wife, would be the beneficiary. Unless there was something illegal about the payout, that made more sense. And it also explained why Delilah's life would be in jeopardy. And Faith had to put that imbecile Collier in charge of finding her. She scrolled through the 16 different texts Collier had sent her since she'd left him at the Mesa Arms. If he was over-talkative in person, he was a freaking Bible in the printed word. He peppered his texts with so much useless information about the weather, the songs on the radio, and his dietary habits, that Faith felt the need to distill the information into bullet points before her head exploded. She reached into her cargo pants pocket and found her spiral notebook and pen. She flipped to a fresh page. At the top, she wrote four headers. Palmer, Harding, Pulaski, Rippey. She tapped her pen on the blank columns underneath the names. Connections. That's what she needed to see. Delilah was married to Dale Harding, possibly his daughter. Harding worked for Rippey. According to the briefing Faith had gotten from Amanda, Angie worked for Kip Kilpatrick, which meant she really worked for Rippey. Faith tapped the pen again. Angie probably knew Harding from way back. Bad cops stuck together. They told themselves they were outsiders because they were the only ones who could get the job done. But the truth was that good cops wanted nothing to do with them. Faith turned to the next page and wrote questions at the top. Why did Angie and Harding meet at Rippey's club? What does Delilah know? Who would want to kill Harding? Who would want to kill Angie? If Harding and Angie knew each other from before, it made sense that one would tap the other for a job with Kip Kilpatrick. Harding had moved into the Mesa Arms 6 months ago, so Faith could reasonably assume that's when he'd started working for Kilpatrick. Angie's bank account had big checks coming in 4 months ago, so that meant she had worked for Kilpatrick at least 4 months. Faith flipped back to the first page. All of the arrows pointed to Marcus Rippey. Her phone buzzed. Another lengthy text came in from Collier. Faith skimmed the lines for meaning, skipping over a report about the indigestion he'd gotten from a gas station hot dog. On Saturday, the day before the murder, Delilah Palmer had rented the Black Ford Fusion from a Hertz location on Howell Mill Road. No security footage existed of the transaction. She had used her Visa card. Collier had put out a bolo on the rental car. He'd also reiterated his heroin mule theory, pointing out that dealers rented cars because they knew that their own rides would be seized by the cops if they were caught dealing out of them. Again, Faith tapped her pen against the notebook. She didn't buy Collier's drug angle. He was a hammer looking for a nail. Delilah had rented the car Saturday, not Sunday or Monday, which implied that she had lined up the car before Harding was murdered. Which could also imply that she knew ahead of time that Harding was in jeopardy and that she might need an escape. But she had used her own license and credit card to book the car. Delilah had been on the streets for years. She was way too savvy to use her own name for a getaway. Faith's phone vibrated again. Another text, blissfully short. Girls say Sousa OD'd 6 months ago. Dead end. Dead. Get it? Faith had to scroll back through her texts to remind herself who Sousa was. She found the pertinent missive time-stamped 2 hours ago. According to some of Collier's sources in Zone 6, Virginia Sousa was another whore for whom Harding had called in a handful of favors. She worked Delilah's street corner. She was fairly violent, considering she had been twice charged with assault against a minor. Faith wondered if that minor had been Delilah Palmer. She looked at the text again. Collier's sign-off was to say that he was going to talk to the younger Horrors who might know something or someone who could point him toward Delilah Palmer's whereabouts. Or he was talking to young Horrors because he was Collier. He had signed off with a series of eggplant emojis that, going by Jeremy's Facebook page, were a stand-in for a bunch of penises. Faith returned to her notebook. Lots of arrows connecting back to Rippy. Lots of questions. No answers. She should have let Collier rot here at the hospital while she tracked down Delilah Palmer. That was the problem with murder cases. You never knew which lead would take you to the solution and which one would sink you into a black hole. Faith was getting the feeling that she had given Collier the good lead. She was going to throw herself off the roof of this building if he ended up lucking into their bad guy. Her phone vibrated again. She didn't want to read another dissertation from Collier's awesome gumshoe file, but ignorance was a luxury she did not have. She looked at the screen. Call from Watanabe, B. Faith stood up and walked down the hall for privacy.
Mitchell?
Is this Special Agent Faith Mitchell? A woman asked.
Yes.
I'm Barbara Watanabe. Violet told me you wanted to talk? Faith had almost forgotten about Harding's next-door neighbor. Thanks for getting back to me. I was wondering if you could tell me about Dale Harding.
Oh, I could give you an earful,
she said, and then she proceeded to do just that, complaining about the smell from his house, the way he sometimes parked his car with the wheels on the grass, his foul language, the loud volume on his television and radio. Faith followed along as best she could. Barb was even more verbose than Collier. She had a way of saying something, then contradicting herself, then restating the first thing she had said, then equivocating, and by the fifth time she'd wound herself into a rhetorical knot, Faith started to understand why Harding had hated her so much.
And don't even get me started on the music.
Faith listened as she started on Harding's music. The same rap album, morning, noon, and night. Her grandson said it was Jay-Z, something called the Black Album. Faith was familiar with the record, which her own son had played loudly behind the closed door of his room because it was the perfect backdrop to his white male privilege and early acceptance to one of the most prestigious universities in the country. Faith tuned back into Barb, looking for a chance to jump in. Finally, the woman had to stop to take a breath.
Did he have visitors?
No, Barb said. Then,
yes, I mean, I think so, yes. He might have had a visitor.
Faith covered her eyes with her hand.
I sense some uncertainty.
Well, yes, that's true. I am uncertain. She had to float Collier's drug mule theory.
Did you see people coming in and out? Like a lot of people who look like they didn't fit in with the neighborhood?
No, nothing like that. I would have called the police. It's just that I thought there might be someone else, another person, over there at some point.
At which point?
Recently. Well, no, that's not right. Last month.
You thought someone was visiting at Dale's house last month?
Yes.
Well, maybe staying there? Visiting might not be the right word.
Faith gritted her teeth.
I mean to say that there could have been someone living over there, I think, when Dale was gone. Now, he was usually not there during the day when he first moved in, but later, he was always there. Which was when the problem started, when he was there. Which sounds mean, but there you go.
Faith tried to wrap her brain around all the information. So, when Dale first moved in 6 months ago, he was never home, but then you noticed that changed last month?
Exactly.
And around the time that changed, you heard sounds from next door that indicated someone other than Dale might be living there?
Yes.
Faith waited for the contradictory no, but it never came.
I heard sounds, you see.
Barb paused before the next hedge.
Not sounds, per se. I mean, they could have been from the television, but who watches television and plays a rap album at the same time?
She immediately went back on herself.
Then again, some people might do that.
They might, Faith said, especially if they wanted to cover up a noise, like a junkie beating on the closet door demanding to be let out. She asked,
Did you ever hear any banging?
Banging?
Someone banging on a wall or banging on a door? Well... She took her time considering the question. Faith called up a mental image of the Tahoe floor plan at the Mesa Arms. The guest room was against the shared wall of the duplex. The master was to the outside, which gave the room more windows, but it also afforded more privacy. Large master closet, ideal for keeping women. Barb said, I guess you could say the noise sounded like a hammer.
Like a hammer pounding something?
Yes, but repeatedly. Maybe he was hanging pictures.
She paused. No, that would have been a lot of pictures. Not that it was constant, the noise, but it was long enough.
I suppose he could have been assembling some furniture.
My son does that for me, but only when he can find the time. My daughter-in-law, you see. But really, with Dale, the excrement was the real problem.
Faith felt her mind boggle.
Say what now? Excrement. You know, she lowered her voice. Doo-doo.
Waste?
Human.
Faith had to repeat the two words together.
Human waste. Yes, in the backyard, she sighed. You see, Dale would rinse out this bucket every evening, and at first I thought that he was painting inside, which made sense because you would listen to music while you paint, yes?
Faith threw out her hand. Sure.
And so I assumed that he was painting his walls, and not a very nice color, but then my grandson went into the backyard one day looking for twigs for Mr. Nim to chew on. Their teeth grow constantly, you see.
Oh! She sounded excited. Thank you, by the way, for finding him. I was persona non grata with my daughter-in-law for that particular crime.
Believe me, she keeps a list. Now, I wasn't a big fan of my own mother-in-law, but you do what you have to do, yes? It's called respect.
Faith tried to get Barb back on track. Let's go back to the excrement.
There were six words she never thought she'd say.
You saw Dale cleaning out the bucket every night?
Yes.
Starting when?
2 weeks ago?
No, she doubled back. 10 days. I would say 10 days ago.
A large bucket. Not the kind you'd use to mop your floor?
Right, yes, for paint.
Or I suppose solvents, but that size, big.
And one day your grandson went into the backyard and he found something?
Smelled something?
Yes. No, both. He smelled something and then he walked over. It was a slime, sort of.
Whatever it was, it got all over the bottom of his shoe. The rat must have been thrilled.
Barb said, I had to wash the sole with the hose. It was disgusting, and his mother was furious at me. Now she's my daughter-in-law, and I know that I have to play by her rules, but honestly.
Did you ask Dale about the excrement?
Oh, no. I couldn't talk to Dale about anything. That would be pointless. He would just curse at me and walk away.
Faith understood why.
Did you ever see a different car at Dale's house other than his white Kia?
Not that I recall.
She showed an unusual certainty.
No, I'm sure I never did.
Are you home much? Faith tried to tread carefully because a lot of times even well-meaning people stretched the truth.
I'm asking because you weren't home this afternoon.
I've been volunteering more at the YMCA. I fold towels, help keep things straightened up. I'm very clean, you see, which is why I had some issues with Dale. I don't like things messed up. There's no reason not to pick something up and put it right back where you found it, yes?
Yes. Faith covered her eyes with her hand again. The woman never met a tangent she didn't travel.
So you stepped up your volunteering to get away from Dale?
Correct. At first, volunteering was just a way to get out of the house for a few hours, and to help people. Of course, to help people, but then it became my only respite away from the noise and the odor.
You smelled the odor, yes. I couldn't live with it all day, you see. It was unbearable.
Faith wondered if Barb's absence had been the very thing Harding was pushing for all along. If he was keeping Delilah locked in the closet to dry her out, he would want to make sure no one would hear her screaming and call the police.
Faith asked,
When did you start spending more time away?
Last week.
So, 7 days ago?
Yes.
Which meant that Dale had managed to drive her out after 3 days of relentless torture.
Barb said, I just gave up. It was getting worse and worse, the smell, the noises. I couldn't take it anymore, and I'm not the type to complain. Violet can verify that.
Faith had the feeling Violet would do no such thing.
Well, I'm very sorry that you had to go through that, Ms. Watanabe. I appreciate your talking to me. If you think of anything else, it's sad, she interrupted. When he first moved in, I thought he was just a lonely old bachelor. He was obviously having health issues. He didn't seem very happy, and I thought to myself, this is a good place for him. We are a community here. We all have our differences. As Violet would say, some of us are to the right of Genghis Khan, and the rest are to the left of Pluto. But we look out for each other, you know?
Faith felt her phone vibrate.
Yes, ma'am, it seemed like a nice place. I need to... You get to a certain age, you learn to look past people's quirks and idiosyncrasies.
She gave a long sigh.
But I'll tell you what, honey, there's no looking past human poop in your backyard.
Well, okay. Faith's phone vibrated again. There was a text from Will.
Thank you, ma'am. Call me if you think of anything else.
Faith ended the call before Barb could toss out another bon mot. She opened Will's text. He'd sent her a photo of the front of Grady, which was Will's way of saying he was at the hospital looking for her. Faith texted back an emoji of a dinner plate and a smiling pile of shit, meaning she would meet him in the food court. She checked the patient board as she walked past the nurse's station. Jane Doe, too, was still critical. Faith didn't bother to ask the nurses for an update. They had her card. They had promised to text the minute the patient was coherent enough to talk. Faith started down the stairs. She tapped the pockets of her cargo pants, making sure her blood testing kit was still there. She had 2 insulin pens left. She had used a third half an hour ago, so she needed to eat. The problem was that Grady only offered fast food restaurants. This was great for their new cardiac wing, but it was awful if you were trying to control your diabetes. Not that she felt like controlling anything right now. Faith longed for the days when she could eat herself into a stupor that drowned out her stress. Will had beaten her to the food court. He was sitting at a quiet table in the back. She didn't recognize him at first because he was in jeans and a beautiful long-sleeved polo that Sarah had obviously sneaked into his wardrobe. He was a nice-looking guy, but he had a habit of blending in, which made him unlike every other cop she had ever met. Will asked, "Is this okay?" He meant the salad he'd ordered for her. Faith stared at the wilted lettuce and white chicken strips that looked like fingers on a dead man. Will's tray had 2 cheeseburgers, a large fry, a large frosty, and a Coke.
Looks good.
Faith sat down, fighting the urge to unhinge her jaw and swallow everything on his tray.
Thanks.
He said, Amanda scheduled an on-the-record interview with Rippy tomorrow.
I know, she caught me up on everything.
Everything?
I know about the bank account you shared with Angie, and I agree that you shouldn't tell Sarah about it.
Will didn't answer. He had never been one for unsolicited advice. I got Laszlo Zivkovic's sheet out of Boston. He's got some misdemeanors. Open bottle, speeding, an assault against a woman, and a felony manslaughter for a bar fight. He stabbed a guy 28 times and left him to bleed to death. Laszlo pulled a dime in big boy prison.
Felony manslaughter? Faith said. He must have had a good lawyer.
I'm assuming he was mobbed up, or was working for the Boston version of Kip Kilpatrick.
Does it bother you what he said about Angie?
I'm more worried that he knows what a snake's vagina feels like.
Faith stared at him. He shrugged.
It's like living with an alcoholic. You're not surprised when somebody tells you that they're at a bar.
Faith had dated an alcoholic for years. Worrying about your partner choking on his own vomit or killing someone in a DUI was not the same as knowing he was out there fucking everything that moved. Which, in retrospect, should have also been one of the things she worried about.
Will said, I met this woman outside Kilpatrick's office, Mrs. Lindsay.
African-American, really put together. She had pearls around her neck, probably in her 70s. She gave me a lot of information about herself.